And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to The Athletic Support, your podcast on the Montreal Canadiens. We're Friday, January the 10th. I'm Marc-Antoine Gonin alongside Arpin Basu. Arpin, first of all, before I know how you are doing, but how was Dominican Republic?
Oh, it was great. You know, I decided to go on vacation in a league where no trades are made and player movement is almost nil.
No, it's so hard to make trades these days.
Yeah, unless you have a PlayStation. But it's, exactly. You know, I leave for a week and the Canadians go out and acquire a top four left D that we've been talking about for years.
Yeah.
And sign one of the, you know, one of the most prolific scorers of our generation. And I was in Punta Cana the whole time.
That's good.
Watching from the beach.
So if
did
we,
me some good though.
Right. So if we want some action in the dog days of February or whatever, we'll send you back there.
Send me back to Punta Cana, man. I will make the sacrifice to go in the interests of everyone's entertainment and so that there's more player movement. I will take one for the team.
Right.
And go sit on the beach.
The athletic correspondent in Punta Cana.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great. Listen, a lot to unpack, this week. A lot has been happening. But let's start with, maybe current affairs, the news of the day. You got Brendan Gallagher who missed four games because of a concussion, that he suffered when Ben Chiarot's knee, hit his head and, he missed four games because of that. Came back on Thursday night, but late Thursday night he experienced, headaches. Which my understanding is that it persisted on Friday morning, decided to go and see a doctor to understand if it was related to the concussion, to any concussion symptoms. And therefore, his presence against the Senators on Saturday is in jeopardy as of now. What do you make of that news? Do you think that the Canadiens did everything they could to prevent that sort of situation from happening?
Yes, I do think that. You know, first of all, you know, there's no universal rule when it comes to coming back from a concussion. There's a protocol in place. I do believe the Canadians respected that. I think their heightened awareness to his current situation, I mean, it's you know, the Canadians don't have the best track record from the past in this, but I do think that they have changed to a certain degree. You know, I mean, Claude had that unfortunate comment earlier this season where he mentioned if we took everyone out who we suspected having a possible concussion, we'd have no one left on the bench. Not the most, you know, not the right thing to say, and gave kind of a bad impression. But I think in this case, because I think Gallagher mentioned that the day after it happened, he felt fine.
Yeah.
And that he felt good to go. And the Canadians still held him out for four games. So it's not as if Gallagher's in control of the green light. You know, I think that's what was the clear thing, was that if it was up to Gallagher, he would have been back sooner than he was. And so, but it is concerning. I mean, it's honestly, you know, considering the way Gallagher plays, it's pretty surprising that he's gone since his rookie season between concussions. But it also would suggest that he's not exactly an expert on how to recognize the symptoms of a concussion and how to, and is not the type of guy who's going to be all that, I could see him not being all that forthcoming about what he's actually feeling. So the fact that he acknowledged the headaches, the fact that the Canadians sent him to the doctor, is a good thing, but I don't know if he came back too early or not, but I do believe that the proper protocols were respected and that, you know, the proper process was in place here.
Right. It struck to me, though, yesterday when, and I mean by that on Thursday, after morning skate, Gallagher seemed to be more cautious or less, you know, less clear about his potential return on that night than Claude Julien was. Claude Julien seemed, you know, very, very close to say, to confirm that yes, he's going to play, no doubt about it. That, whereas Brendan seemed to be a little bit more, how would you say, tentative about it.
Well, I don't think Gallagher had all the information, you know. I think Claude is the one who speaks to the doctors. I don't think the doctors go to the player. That's generally not how it happens. It's not the first time we've heard a player coming back from any injury, let alone a concussion, who didn't know his own status. And we had to get it
well,
from
it
Claude.
It happened today with Matthew Pekka. Matthew Pekka did not know that he had a green light, and Claude told us that he was indeed ready to play.
Yeah, exactly. So Claude is the one who gets the information directly from either the training staff or the doctors or what have you, or medical people. It's not unusual that the player would be kind of the last to know in a way, or at least would find out after the coach. So, you know, that didn't really surprise me. I mean, it's all indications were, and I think, you know, Gallagher himself would recognize as soon as he was skating on a line with his regular line mates and getting power play reps at the morning skate, that generally means you're playing that night. But I think when information is so closely monitored in an organization like the Canadians and in most hockey teams in general, you're not gonna, you know, you're more reluctant to sort of announce something on your own. You want to let the coach do that. So that's kind of how I saw that. But I mean, even before the game, it was pretty clear, speaking to Gallagher, that he believed he was playing that night.
Right.
Just couldn't flat out say it.
So. The real question now is what now? If he was to miss any time because of that, I mean, the Canadians are leaving the door open to something, a headache that would not be related to a concussion, so whether an illness, a virus, whatever.
Right.
But considering the situation in the standings, obviously the Canadians are eager to come back on in the win column. I don't know how, you know, the playoffs are still an idea that they seriously entertain, but they definitely look to win a game and finish that streak ASAP. So, but overall, it would be wise to treat Brendan Gallagher's case with a lot of caution from this point on, because, you know, if he's healthy, fine, he can go and he can help the team, but it shows you how tricky it is with that protocol and with head injuries, where you don't always know. You think the symptom seems to be gone, and next thing you know, well, they reappear.
I mean, that's the thing, it's you don't know, and that's why, like, people who make definitive statements on, like, oh, just sit him, you know, I mean, it's sit him till the All-Star break, or sit him for however many, you know, it's, yeah, that's fine, but that's just not the reality that professional athletes live with, you know. I mean, it's at one point, if you're deemed healthy, you're going to play. It's what you do for a living. It's just normal. But, you know, I think in a grander scheme of things, like, you know, Pierre LeBrun went on insider trading on TSN prior to the game against the Oilers, and mentioned how his understanding was that the Canadians were basically looking at the bye week as their decision-making point. So if they could go on a run between now and the bye week, then maybe they would consider not going into full sell mode, let's say. I don't know if they would necessarily be looking at buy mode, but, you know, giving this team an opportunity to get healthy and maybe make a late push towards the playoffs is something that apparently they were still considering prior to that loss against the Oilers. And in my eyes, now they basically have to run the table between now and the bye week in order to even consider the possibility of not starting to put the wheels in motion of a team that's going to miss the playoffs and is going to sell off assets. It's not entirely completely crazy. It's still a long shot.
They probably don't want to have regrets and say we should have done it. We should have at least tried.
You look at the teams that they're chasing and there's a lot between them and these teams, but basically Columbus and Philly and Carolina are basically sort of the three teams that they're looking at now, with Florida in the way and a couple other teams. And so it's not outside the realm of possibility the way that the season has gone, that two or three teams will hit a slump while the Canadians hit a streak, and then all of a sudden they're back in the playoff race. Realistically speaking, it's not likely, but, you know, professional sports organizations are not always don't always live in the realm of likelihood. You know, they live in the realm of possibility, and so that's how they have to look at it, because they're professional athletes and it's a professional sports organization. But when it comes to the injury management part of it, you know, I think it speaks to, in a certain way, you know, how they manage those situations. If they still feel they're playing for something, it's harder to tell a seemingly healthy Brendan Gallagher to just not play because we don't want to take any risks.
Right.
If the medical staff says he's healthy and if he says he feels good and he's passed all the protocols, baseline tests are fine, everything's good, it's hard to hold him out when you're still harboring this faint hope of getting back in it. But if they were being more realistic about it and saying, listen, the chances are nil, especially considering we've won 7 out of, well, at that time it was 7 out of 25 games. It's now 7 out of 26 games. What are the chances we reel off 5 wins in a row here? Probably not very good. But that's not how sports people think. And it's, you know, it's fine for media and fans to think that way, but athletes and sports organizations don't think that way.
No, the only thing that you hope in this case is that they'll treat the concussion differently than any other injury, because in any other injury, you can play through a certain level of pain. The guy is not at 100%. He'll play despite the fact that he's not 100%. Mm-hmm. In a case of a head trauma and concussion, you have to be 100% to come back. So that's.
I think it's worth noting that Claude Julien made that very clear, that if this is concussion related, in Gallagher's case, there is absolutely no way he's playing. He made that very obvious, that that's what they just want to confirm. And not having that confirmation when he spoke to us this morning, he left it open to the fact, to the possibility that the headaches are not concussion related. Realistically speaking, you know, it's hard to believe that a guy coming off a concussion would suddenly randomly get virus-based headaches. It's just like, it just doesn't seem like a very likely outcome here, but you know, I mean, you gotta kinda take Claude at his word, and that if those headaches are deemed to be related to the concussion again, that he's not playing. And he was very definitive about that. So,
yeah,
you know, I think we need to – sometimes it's important to realize that the Canadians in particular, but, you know, sports teams in general, don't like to say things until they have actual definitive answers on something. And in this case, he hadn't visited with the doctors yet. I mean, Gallagher. So Julien didn't necessarily have the latest information, and so he just left all possibilities open.
Right. Because they don't want to breed more speculation than there already is.
Exactly, yeah. And they don't want to say something that will eventually bite them.
Yeah. So if we take the idea of injuries in a bigger picture, it's become a theme. I would say since since Ilya Kovalchuk was signed by the Canadiens and Marc Bergevin came in front of us to explain why he was signing Kovalchuk, and he explained the fact that it was, well, in not in so many words, but he referred to that that stretch of 10 games until the bye week that was probably a key for their season. And he mentioned also the fact how the team had been impacted by the injuries. There is no doubt that it has had a major impact on the team when you look at the before and after of the team, the way when they lost Jonathan Drouin and Paul mm-hmm. Byron also. It was a different team from that point on. Eventually, they lost Joel Armia, who was having a career year. It piled up. That being said, and now it's Ben Sherratt. He's not supposed to be out for a long time.
But, he's not playing Saturday, though.
But he's not playing, yeah. That being said, I think that there are certain limits to, quote unquote, the excuse that you can use when it comes to injuries and how it explains the team's performance this year. And I'll explain. I don't know what you'll think about that, but you know, when Bergevin took the microphone and said, "Well, we've got three of our top nine guys that are out," and when you got three top nine guys out at the same time, he obviously was referring to Drouin, Gallagher, and Armia. It becomes very difficult. That situation, prior to Saturday's game against Ottawa, lasted four games because Gallagher missed four games. You had Byron. Well, Byron was not effective at all at the beginning of the season. He was pretty much a non-factor in the Canadiens season so far. So basically, it comes down to Armia and Drouin going down with injuries, and to the fact that for the bulk of the season, the Canadiens could not recover from the loss of those two players.
Yeah, well, really, I mean, the demarcation line is the Drouin injury. I mean, it's, you know, it's crazy we're even talking about it this way when you think back to training camp and how everyone was freaking out about how poor a training camp Jonathan Drouin was having and how, you know, there was legions of fans who wanted him either traded for picks or sent to Laval or just off the team, period. That he would be such a vital player, and in fact, that's not the case. It just so happens that is
a tipping point.
A tipping point. I don't think it's necessarily related to Jonathan Drouin necessarily, because a whole slew of other things started happening. Carey Price kind of lost his net a little bit. Defensively, the Canadiens became just a complete and utter shit show. I mean, excuse the expression, but that's what it was in November. It was just like this series of defensive miscues leading to two-on-ones and three-on-twos and three-on-ones and all sorts of odd-man rushes. And just did not, just no longer looked recognizable. It did not look like the team we saw very consistently all of last season and over the first 6 weeks of this season. So, you know, the one thing I will say about the injuries, though, is you go back to, I just happen to be looking back to what Marc Bergevin said prior to the season. He had a end of training camp press conference sometime around October 1st and mentioned how, you know, the Canadiens are a four-line team. And in order for us to be effective, we need all four lines to be effective, because if one night Deno's line's not going, then Domi's line's got to pick up the slack. And if his line's not going, then KK's line's got to pick up the slack. And that's how we operate, because we don't have what I kind of refer to as that anchor talent, where that talent that you can always rely on to be there and pull your team through when some of the other guys aren't pulling their weight. So the Canadiens aren't that kind of team. They're a team that, you know, it's the Canadiens are a team of like death by a million paper cuts kind of thing is how they manage to beat teams, is just constantly wave after wave of forwards coming at you, speed, energy, forechecking, all that stuff. And so when you start losing those guys and you start replacing them with AHL guys, it's the system breaks down. And so I agree with you that the injury thing has been overblown, and it has not hit this team as hard as it's hit some other teams, Pittsburgh, for instance. But Pittsburgh has that anchor talent. You know, you lose Crosby, you have Malkin, who has always stepped up his game when Crosby's been out, yeah, and is one of the best players in NHL history. I mean, by any metric. So they have that. a lot of teams have that, where if you lose some of your peripheral secondary guys, if you still have your primary guys, you can get through it. The Canadiens' primary guy is in net.
Yeah.
And, you know.
And he has not, he has been an anchor, but the other way around.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he is not having a good season. So, in theory, if you're, superstar player is playing like that, you could get through these injuries. He could single-handedly win you games, and that's in principle why he's here and why he makes the amount of money he does and why he the team is built around him is his ability to do that. But lacking that talent up front, that one special talent, and instead going with a whole bunch of good players as opposed to one or two great players, makes them susceptible to a situation like
right.
this.
Right. But so it becomes a question of depth, really. And I wonder, you know, because we referred in different articles on The Athletic to the strong link, weak link,
yes.
theory. And so the fact you just illustrated how the Canadiens, with their different waves and their relentlessness, are a weak link type of team. But, if you have two or three forwards that are going down, no matter where they are in the lineup, they could be third line forwards. You need to have replacement guys that are pretty much to that level. You would need to have guys, you would need to have like Arturi Lehkonen on the fourth line to, for that principle to hold up so that it can, despite injuries, for the team to keep his level. But it's just, that's not how it works.
And that's not how it works. But just to, you know, I think what we've seen the last 2 years in the draft, you should eventually, in theory, have this feeder system in Laval. When all these guys start reaching Laval and they're slowly getting there, you know, Evans is there and Vedemo's now there and you know, there's some other guys, you know, Brooke is there. But when you start, all these guys they've drafted the last 2 years, when they start entering, becoming pros and entering the organization and being there, that's when I think they'll have what you're talking about, where you could have a viable replacement in Laval, to come in and get an opportunity mm-hmm. as opposed to filling a hole. You
right.
know, I mean, right now they're filling holes. Whereas if you have your younger players there, your prospects there, then they could come up and be like, okay, well, this is my shot and I have the talent to be in this league. I'm going to show it. You know, it's just a different dynamic. And I think that's what they're building towards. But they're not quite there yet because a lot of the guys they've drafted the last couple of years are still in junior or college or whatever. So,
but it's funny because at some point after Byron and Joy went down, so they called up guys as replacements, but those guys were Udo and Pekka. So
yeah.
It's like welcome to last year. You know, it's like a situation that Marc Bergevin and I suppose the coaching staff and everybody, they tried to get away from for the better part of last season, trying to figure out a potent fourth line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a couple of injuries after that, well, you come back to that same equation because those guys, I don't know if it's the fact that Phil Veron in Laval was hurt too, and he would have been the guy
yeah.
that called up in an instance like that. But, you know, you see the Pekkas, the Udons, Dale Weiss comes back. So it's been, their depth has really been tested, and it has put so much pressure on other guys, that they lost their balance. But, I want to take you on have your take on I'll shift
well,
gears.
Let me
yeah,
just, well, hang on.
Sure.
Let me just comment on that because I've had this conversation with Matthew Peckham, and he's one of the most self-aware players I've ever actually dealt with. Is Matthew Peckham? I enjoy talking to him because he's just real. And so I had this conversation with him about being a tweener, which is what all those guys you just mentioned are all tweeners. They're a little too good for the AHL, and they're not quite good enough for the NHL. They're in between. And if there was a league in between the AHL and the NHL, those guys would be perfect for that league. And so that's the difference, is that of what I'm talking about is having future NHLers available to you as opposed to a group of tweeners. And, you know, Pekka was just, I asked him about that reality of being a tweener and how difficult it is because – he always feels that he's so close to being an NHL player, but he just never quite gets there.
Yeah.
And, you know, every opportunity he gets at the NHL, something goes wrong and you know, results don't come, and then he goes back to the AHL and goes to the AHL, and he feels he's too good for that league, and he does super well. Charles Houdon, same thing. He's the Laval Rockets All-Star representative this season, and he's
too good. Yeah, he's too good for that.
So, yeah. But it's clear that each of these guys, Verone could probably be included in there, even though he had a good season in Philadelphia last year. You know, Riley Barber, same deal. I mean, these are all guys who are just a little too good for the AHL and not quite good enough for the NHL. Whereas if at one point, if these kids that they've drafted the last 2 years, if those are the guys in Laval, because none of the guys we just mentioned, Barber, Verone, Pekka, Houdon, throw Weiss in there, none of those guys, you don't see them as being eventual NHLers.
No, it's not
reasonable to think that. But
they're there to make the Rocket competitive.
Exactly. And so, as opposed to that being the replacement alternative, to having younger players who you hope to see in the NHL at some point, I think there's a different dynamic there. There's a different mindset. There's a different motivation factor for these kids. Like it's just, yes, you become younger when injuries hit and you replace them with young kids, but it's just, there's a difference there in my mind that is palpable, in the sense that, you know, you're dealing with a future NHL player as opposed to someone who is clearly defined as an AHL player.
But what do you have to say about that, Pekka? Because he cannot recognize himself as a tweener and say, yeah, I'm not quite good enough for the NHL.
But he's able to recognize the reality of his situation. I mean, it's how long has he played in the AHL and how long has he excelled in the AHL?
Yeah.
And he has not yet been able to establish himself as an NHL player, even though he, you know, through a wild set of circumstances, wound up as a UFA and was, you know, paid handsomely by the Canadiens and rewarded with a second year, and there was competition for his services, and then comes out of that whole experience thinking, oh, look at all these NHL teams, they want me and all this stuff, and isn't able to get it done. It was by many metrics one of the worst players in the NHL last season. And he recognized that. You know, he even admitted at one point that the contract talks and everything that happened in free agency led him to believe that he was something he wasn't. Mm-hmm. And that he had to go back to his core identity as a professional hockey player and not try to be this guy that he's not. And he struggled with that last season and was very open about it. And now, you know, being sent to Laval and basically primarily playing in the AHL this season, drove that point home. And he just spoke about how frustrating it is to be like just a whisker away from your lifelong dream.
Yeah.
And you're right there, but that last little bit that you have to get to become an NHL player has been elusive to him for many years, like for several years. And he can taste it, but it's still, that last step is the hardest one.
You know?
And when you reach a certain age, the hockey world kind of moves on from you, you know? I mean, that's just the reality of the situation, is that you hit 25, 26, and, you know, hockey people kind of be like, okay, you are what you are, and that's it.
Not to mention the fact that when those guys get their opportunities because of injuries to other players, they're often asked to play a different role than what they've – that made them successful so far. A guy like Riley Barber, for example, leading scorer – well – typically, he's a goal scorer in the American League. He's a guy who will fill the net. He's going to help you offensively. He's going to be on your first line in the AHL. He's called up, and he's going to play on a fourth line. And the primary goal, at least in Montreal, of the fourth line is not to be scored against.
Yes.
So you have to be defensively responsible. And whether or not you have a nose for the net or whatever, that becomes secondary because, mm-hmm. you know, it's only a bonus. If you're very effective defensively, you might have a little extra few minutes of ice time that will maybe give you a chance to showcase yourself offensively, but that's not the primary goal. So you ask an offensive player in the AHL to be, when he's called up, to be asked to do like a very defensive responsibility, a defensive role, in limited ice time and under pressure of, you know, no margin of error. Because if you don't do the job, if you mess up, there's going to be another guy that's going to take your place. And eventually that's what happened.
Yeah. That's the difference to me is that if at some point, if this whole plan is permitted to run its course, meaning if the GM remains in place and the coach remains in place and they fully commit to what they're doing now, I feel like if this situation were to happen again, say 2 years from now, you know, you would have a whole bunch of guys that you had drafted and developed yourself instead of all these disparate free agents and trade acquisitions and what have you. And you would have like this serious merit-based competition going on in Laval for who would get to make the jump, and it just, they'd be better prepared for a situation like this. And right now they organizationally did not have the depth to handle this. It's obvious at this point, but I think even at the beginning of the season, the organization would admit that they don't have the depth to handle losing 3 to 4 or even 5 over the course of the season, top 9 forwards at any given point. They couldn't handle that. It's not because of the way the team is built and because of the types of players they have in Laval, they couldn't do it. So yes, the injuries are a lame excuse, and you know, frankly, no one cares about your injury situation because every team has injury situations. But at the same time, the reality of this organization is that they couldn't have this, and it's become blatantly obvious why, because they just don't have viable replacements available for these guys.
Do you believe in that weak link method of operating, or is it just you do that by default because you don't have like the workhorses up front, the guys, the thoroughbreds, yeah. I should say, you know, like the top offensive guys that will carry your team. So and because you don't have it, you'll just spread the good among the fourth line.
Well, that's exactly what I think. That's why, for their reality, this was a good way to go. You know, last season, I think, you know, coaching staff and management recognized what they needed, but they also recognized that we were going to need to draft these players or acquire them by trading veterans like a Max Pacioretty and getting a Nick Suzuki back. But in the meantime, this is the way we'll be competitive.
Yeah.
And yeah, you're absolutely right. It is a default move because in a perfect world, you would have superstar forwards and superstars on defense and superstar in goal, and you'd be winning Stanley Cups. You know, I mean, but that's not what they have.
Because it works. Even though the Canadians did not make the playoffs last year, you could say that system to a certain extent worked. I mean, they were in a normal season, based on the amount of points they got, they should have made the playoffs. But you look around the league, I think that the New York Islanders are built like that. Mm-hmm. This year, the Arizona Coyotes are a perfect example of a weak link team, and they're thriving.
Yeah, so they're getting goaltending.
That too. Yeah,
that's good segue.
It's a big difference, and yeah. same for the Islanders.
Same for the Islanders, and yeah. It's, you know, I mean, that's, I think, leads us to the elephant in the room. You know, Carey Price came out and spoke today. He didn't speak after the game against Edmonton. Basically, well, let's listen to a very perfect summation of what Carey Price is living right now.
I'm not dwelling on negative attitudes or anything like that. Just continue to do the things that I feel like will make me successful and not worry about the results, focus on the results.
What's caused you the most frustration through the course of the season?
Just not getting the results.
So there you have it. So what he's trying to do is forget the results and get past the frustration and focus on the process. But what's frustrating him is the results.
Yeah.
So
where
do you go from there? And he basically, you know, he basically repeated the same answer countless amounts of times until by the end said, you know, that's really, you guys can ask me all the questions you want. This is all I really have to say about it. That I'm going to try and focus on the positive, and I'm going to try and focus on the things I need to do to be successful. And try and stay out of negativity. But the reality is that the results lead nowhere but negativity, because the results haven't been there for him.
No.
And he's not being the superstar goalie, the anchor star that I was talking about before. he hasn't been that guy. He's almost been the opposite of that guy.
It's when you say come back, or when he says come back to being successful, what I'm intrigued is what is his definition of successful? Obviously, stopping pucks would be the basic metric.
Yeah, sure.
But, and it's probably, and I, while I was listening to him, I was tempted to ask him that question, but I sort of knew that's exactly what he would have answered me. But is his frame of reference the goalie that he was late last season, the goalie that he was when he won all those trophies? You know, there has to be a new normal now or a certain status because of injuries and because of age, where there's a certain level that he can hope to attain. And if he's going to be disappointed if he doesn't reach a level that's even higher than that, then everything falls apart.
I think Carey Price's base metric is wins. That's really all. And that's the case for 99% of goaltenders. They really could care less about their goals against average and save percentage and whatever. If they're a winning goaltender, that's good enough for them. And I think in his case, you know, he sees all the other problems on the team, but in his mind, and he has said this before, that he feels he is the type of player who can mask other issues on the team.
Yeah.
And he did that. He's done that for the bulk of his career. And that's what he feels is his value to this team, is that we might have problems elsewhere, but I can compensate for those problems.
It's a responsibility that he's taken with pride.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? I mean, like down the stretch last season, I mean, he had a rough month of November last year, but from that point on, or you could say from the point that Shea Weber came back to the lineup, he was a top 5 or 7 goalie in the league. I mean, he was one of the better goaltenders in the NHL.
Yeah.
We saw the same thing happen in November this year, but it was different in the sense that, as I mentioned before, the Canadiens were a complete disaster defensively, and, you know, you don't want to be making excuses for your highest paid player and number one goaltender, but I think those excuses were somewhat legitimate in November, whereas now they're a bit less so. You know, I mean, the Canadiens have tightened up defensively. They don't give up nearly as many odd man rushes. The grade A-plus chances that they were allowing in November are fewer now. But, you know, when you hear the team consistently say, it seems like every time we make a mistake, it's in our net, what are they talking about? You know, I mean, you take that statement and take Carey Price saying in the past that I feel I'm a guy who can help a team overcome those mistakes or what have you, especially when there are young players on the team who, if a mistake is made and Price makes a big save, it's a very different feeling than if a mistake is made and the puck is in the back of your net and you feel responsible for it. That's kind of what the value of Carey Price is that he can avoid that feeling for not only the young players, but for the veterans or whoever. But the overwhelming sense on this team now is every mistake they make winds up in their net. And no one's going to come out and say it this way, but that is an indictment of their goaltending.
Yeah.
It really is.
We were looking last night after the game at some advanced metrics. I don't know how easy it is to explain that in a podcast, but I thought that it was pretty revealing when it came to expected goals against, to see Carey Price so far down the list, where actually you would hope that a goalie of his caliber is actually at the top of the list, but he's in a company.
Well, at least in the top 10, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you.
I can explain. Okay. Yeah, so evolving hockey, excellent sight, has a metric called, expected. You know, goals saved above expectation is basically what it comes down to. And so what it means is that, you know, I'm sure most of our listeners have heard us refer to the term expected goals. There's a formula, you know, different sites calculate it different ways, but basically based on shot location, based on the type of shot, whether it's a rebound or not, whether there's all sorts of different factors that they put into whether whether a shot should be expected to go in or not. So that same principle is used on goaltenders, that how many expected goals have they faced and how many of those shots have they saved above expectation. And so Carey Price right now has allowed is at minus 13.03 when it comes to goals saved above expectation, which means he is below expectation by 13 goals, which is a massive figure. I mean, his expected goals against this season at 5-on-5 is at 93.4. And these are score and venue adjusted. That's why they're decimal points. But, you know, he's at 93.4 expected goals against, and he's allowed 106.4.
So when the Canadians give up so many odd man rushes in the month of November that their defense breaks down totally, a lot of those situations are considered an expected goal. So
right.
They're not even taken into account that Carey Price has to make a stop in those situations because it will be the team fault.
Yeah.
So when he is below the expected goals scored against him, it means that even when you take into consideration all those on-man rushes and all those mistakes, he's also responsible on his own on top of that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, he is below the threshold. Like, basically, an average goalie should be somewhere around even in goals saved above expectation. Like, you make the save you're expected to make, and you give up goals on unexpected goals. And so he's at minus 13 right now. And you take away the adjustment, it's minus 12.86. But basically, among all goalies in the league who have played at least 700 minutes at 5-on-5, you know, he's the fifth worst in this metric.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, if you look at it from the other direction, he's sitting 40th. And there's 31 teams in the league. So, do the math. And so it's like, you know, it's not what, and to be fair here, okay, like, I mean, if you look at the bottom, like, Matt Murray's 39th, Price is 40th, Alex Stalock is 41st, not a huge shock there, but Bobrovsky, who just signed a $10 million deal, is 42nd, Pekka Rinne scored the first goal of his career last night, is 43rd, Devin Dubnyk's 44th. So Price is not alone.
Those are all goalies that 3-4 years ago were the cream of the crop of the NHL.
Absolutely. And so I think, you know, my concern, there's a couple of things that I find concerning in this situation. A is Price's propensity of late to give up really the backbreaking goal, the goal that kind of puts what is clearly a fragile team right now on that brink of fragility. You know, the one to me was the Riley Sheehan goal against the Oilers, which made it 2-1, and to have players admit afterwards that going into the third period up 2-1, you know, they were not confident in that situation, because that's striking to hear professional hockey players say that, but they said it's a fact. Like, it's in the back of our minds. We've blown leads and you start playing tight. So in those circumstances, you need your superstar goalie to do something, you know, and you know, it would help if Nate Thompson would have tucked that puck in the net and re-upped the lead to 2 goals, definitely. And it would have helped if they'd scored a few more goals, for sure. But, you know, it's 7 times in 9 starts, the Price has given up at least 3 goals. And what do you do at that point?
It's meant to, the way this team is built, again, it's more likely that Carey Price has to make a commanding save, like a decisive save that's going to, you know, factor the outcome of the game, more than Nate Thompson scoring a timely goal.
Yeah, and the point being is that those saves, like, his value is, you know, when Price is on, you hear his teammates talk, and his impact on their confidence is massive. It's just like when he's on, then they feel free to play, and they feel free to make mistakes because they know he's back there and he can erase them. And there's just, no matter what his teammates or his coaches or anyone says right now, there's no way that feeling exists the way he's playing now, where, you know, I mean, it's not like he's playing terribly, but he's not making that big save, that save that you're like, wow, it's so rare that he comes in and erases a goal that you thought for sure was going in. And that's where that confidence that he brings to his team stems from that. And it's not there right now.
We all know the parameters of his contract. Long-term contract at $10.5 million makes him extremely difficult to trade. And anyway, he holds all the cards, because whenever he would decide that his time in Montreal is up and he wants to go to greener pastures, well, he would choose the time and the location, and basically the Canadians would try to find a fit and try to swing a deal that that they'd be happy with. When do you, you know, when I think of what he said at the end of the last season, and again to you over the summer, to the fact that for him the time to win was now, that he did not want to be, you know, just hoping for the future, looking at those kids arrive and say, oh, well, maybe eventually. For him, the clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. I suggest My Cousin Vinny for all those who understand the reference of the clock is ticking.
Yes.
I wonder when I, you know, a few months afterwards in this situation, in a season like this one where everything has gone to hell, how much closer do you think he is now from saying, you know what, I think that the time is now, the time has come for me to move on and, you know, go somewhere else?
I don't think that's the way he thinks personally. I think he's, you know, one thing about Carey Price is he has, for a guy who doesn't express how he feels all that much, he has a pretty acute sense of self-awareness of when he's playing poorly and when he's not playing poorly, when he's playing well. And when he's playing poorly, because of what we talked about earlier, in the sense that where his source of pride is his ability to carry the team to a level above what people expect. And that's what he said before last season. I feel I have the ability to take the team to another level. Mm-hmm. When he is not only not doing that, but he is one of the primary reasons they're playing below expectations, no one has to send a news bulletin to Carey Price to say this. He knows this. It's clear. And so that's why I think, you know, if this was happening despite him, then maybe he would think the way that you were describing. Like, okay, listen, there's nothing else I can do here. We're not going to win here. Even if I play lights out, nothing else is going to happen. That's not what's happening here. He is part of the problem, to be generous. Like, he is a significant part of the problem. And I don't think he would disagree with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if I know him the way I think I know him, I would think his focus would be like, okay, how can I get this team out of this situation? That's what I think would be his mindset right now.
Right.
And I mean, whether that's the case, I could be wrong, but I mean, it just seems to me like when he's not performing to his standard, and his standard being making this team a winning team, I don't see him pointing the finger at others and say, I want out. I would see him pointing the finger at himself and being like, I need to be better.
Right. But, you know, it's when I think of Patrick Roy in 1995, when he raised his hands and he wanted a change of scenery, because he was pretty much in the same situation where he had been the backbone of that team and the main reason why it had been a successful team. And at some point he was just looking for a way to start anew and find ways to get better, because he was struggling. And so when you look at, you know, if he comes to a point where he sort of runs out of ways to say, okay, well, what can I do to improve? If you just transplant yourself into another location, and it's worked so well for guys like Marc-André Fleury, for example, you know, where he was half the goalie at the end in Pittsburgh. He was half the goalie that he's been since he moved to Vegas. Well, I would understand Price at some point to say, you know what, I'm 32 years old and I know I still got plenty of great hockey in me. What if I just try it somewhere else?
Well, that's the only realistic window for that to happen is the expansion draft, just like Marc-André Fleury. It's the same scenario, because that's the only scenario under which a team would be able to acquire him without having to work out a trade. So it would require him lifting his no move and allowing the Canadiens to expose him to that. And then Seattle saying, okay, we want this guy at this price point, which is, I don't think, a slam dunk. I don't know if, depending on how he plays between now and
exactly,
then.
Exactly, yeah. The current version of Carey Price,
right,
at 10.5
million.
I think
everyone's assuming that Seattle would jump at the chance to get a Carey Price, and maybe they would, no matter how he plays between now and then. But it's not guaranteed. But I think that's the only way I could see a scenario under which Carey Price changes teams before the end of this contract. That's, I don't see a way the Canadiens could work out a trade without eating some of that salary and maybe even adding a sweetener for a team to take on that salary. I mean, the reality is that any team that would want someone like Carey Price is either a contending team or a team on the cusp of contending. Many of those teams are pretty tight on the cap because their money is spent elsewhere. Like they, it's becomes the combination of his no movement clause, so his right to determine where he winds up, and the fact that anyone who would be interested likely does not have the money to pay him.
They need help in goal. They need to have. And they need to be competitive enough to consider him to be the missing piece.
Yes.
So all of these parameters put together
make it almost impossible.
Right.
It makes it all nearly impossible to trade him. So to me, the only realistic scenario, and frankly, you know, if you look over the last few years, it's gotten to the he's in a Craig Anderson situation where every second year he's good and every second year he's bad. And this is what he's having a bad season this year. He might still turn it around, but right now he's having a bad season. Last year he was good. Hit a bad stretch, but overall, good season. Year before, terrible. Year before that, quite good. So this is disconcerting when he is your franchise player. But if that continues, then next season he should be good.
That's right.
And so,
but the general manager in Seattle is Ron Francis. And uh-huh. Ron Francis has shown interest in Carey Price before.
Yeah.
So,
and Ron Francis, what brought Ron Francis' downfall in Carolina was his inability to find a goaltender.
Yeah.
Largely. That's largely the source of what cost him his job as Hurricanes GM.
Right.
So,
Terry would have been a great fit in Carolina.
I agree.
You know, that ship has sailed because now they've got young stars to pay. But it's still.
And they've got a defense where they don't necessarily need a superstar goalie.
No, that's
they
true.
Just need an adequate goalie,
right?
And that's more and more the case with many teams. Is that you get average goaltending? As long as you build a team in front of an average goaltender, you should be able to win. That's become the reality of the NHL now. And the Canadiens aren't part of that reality.
So for fans who are eager to see the Canadiens make some big moves, and they consider them out of the hunt, and say, "Well, let's sell everything." A clearance sale. Carey Price is not going to be sold for back bucks anytime soon.
Well, and he would not approve of that necessarily.
Well, that's it.
There's all sorts of facts. I mean, this is what drives me nuts when I just see, trade price.
Easier said than
done. Yeah. I mean, it's just not realistic. It's just not. This GM is not going to do it, so you need to get a new GM willing to do it. B, Carey Price would have to agree to it. And C, you need to find a partner.
Yeah.
Perfect storm of it not happening, basically.
That being said, I'm sure that there are going to be moves at some point down the road. The Canadiens are going to have their bye week in 2 weeks. After that point, I suspect that Marc Bergevin is going to make some decisions. He could decide to wait and sell some assets at the trade deadline, but he could also try to find a trading partner earlier than that, and that trading partner, depending on who he's interested in, could choose to pay a little bit more just to secure that asset, secure that player that he wants to acquire, and avoid a bidding war at the time of the trade deadline. So if Marc Bergevin decides to make some moves, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to happen around February 25th. It could happen earlier than that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they continue losing between now and the bye week, there's no doubt in my mind, that's exactly what the Canadiens management team is going to spend that week doing.
Right.
Is testing the market for players like Tomas Tatar, maybe even Jeff Petrie, who knows. But the guys who will be up at the end of next season, maybe even Max Domi, if they don't think that they can get him under a reasonable contract, you'd have to start considering a lot. I mean, forget the obvious cases that you could put out there, like a Nate Thompson would probably be of value to
Scandella.
Kovalchuk, even if he continues producing the way he has through three games. But, I mean, you know, maybe Kovalchuk becomes an asset that you can actually get something for. But those are obvious cases. But the guys, the 2021 guys, are things that this team will probably start having to consider. And if he does actually put Tomas Tatar on the trade market, he would, I believe, become the most valued forward on the trade market between now and the deadline. And that would be a cool, an interesting asset for Mark Bergevin to shop around. And one thing I will say is that if he does decide to become a seller, Mark Bergevin has proven to be a very adept seller at the deadline. Yes. He's very good at it.
Yeah, so. For sure. And also the other thing is that the Canadians, they might consider that they've got already an interesting crop of prospects, but how many of them will become those anchor talent guys? There's not that many of them, and I think that they'd be in a wise position to try to get another first round pick if they could for the upcoming draft. I think that it could prove useful to have two instead of one.
So. That's the thing, is that you don't know which prospect will become that guy, and that's the beauty of having so many.
Right.
Is that since you don't know, keeping so many, there's value to that too, because you don't know which one to trade, and so you got to wait and see and give yourself the most lottery tickets. But this is, I just want to leave, I think we should wrap it up. But I mean, just on price, I checked this out the other day. And on January 9th of last year, I know we're January 10th, but bear with me. So on January 9th of last year, he had a .909 save percentage in all situations. It was .911 at even strength. It was .892 shorthanded. Not that dissimilar from his numbers.
.892 shorthanded is very good.
It's very good, yeah. I mean, I think this season he's at .868. That was prior to the game against Edmonton. Mm-hmm. So he was at .902 all situations, .908 even strength, and .868 shorthanded. And frankly, the shorthanded number I would not pin on him entirely. The Canadiens' penalty kill has been poor, tactically poor, structurally poor. He's part of it, but I wouldn't put too much of that. I wouldn't put an overly large amount of that on him. Last season, from January 9th to the end of the season, his all-situation save percentage was .926. His even-strength save percentage was .929. And his shorthanded save percentage was .895, which isn't a big boost from the .892 he was at. But still, it's a 17-point jump in all situations and an 18-point jump in even strength. And that was playing almost every game. So that's the thing about when everyone says, let's just tank, which in theory is probably a good idea. You got Alexis Lafreniere sitting there, might as well get the most lottery balls you can. I get that. Because right now they're closer to the bottom than they are to a playoff spot. The problem with that is you never know when that kind of transformation can happen with this goalie. Like, you never know. And if that does happen, they can't tank. And when they start getting healthy bodies back,
they're going to be too good.
They'll be a competitive team. Yeah. You know, they might not win. They're not going to win enough to get into the playoffs, I'm willing to bet. But they'll be a tough team to beat. And you can't tell professional athletes to lose on purpose, because they won't.
No.
And plus, that just creates a horrible, toxic environment in your organization, and no sports team would want to do that. So it's very easy to sit on the sideline and say, oh, we'll just start losing games and trade everyone and play all these AHL guys and lose as much as you can. It's not that simple when you have a potential .929 even strength goalie sitting there that could just emerge at any given moment. Like, it's impossible to predict. So see what happens. But that's kind of a proof of what Price is capable of, and what his best and worst right there. We saw it last season at right around this time.
Yeah.
And this was right around the time they lost all faith in Niemi, and basically Price played every game and it did not affect his numbers one bit. So we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. But you're right. I mean, they're in a full lineup, they're too good to be a lottery team. So,
well, not like a top, like a, they're too good to be like a bottom five lottery
team. That's what I mean. I'm not talking about a team who are going to be so lucky that they get that
right,
that number one pick out of the blue, or number two pick. But I mean, being in the discussion, like the Senators or the Red Wings can be, you know,
right.
So it'll be interesting to see. So anyway. Maybe that they can rest Gallagher a little bit longer. Okay.
Well, it's a real 4-point game Saturday in Ottawa.
There you go.
And in the opposite direction. So let's see what happens.
All right. Thank you everybody for listening. We wish you a nice weekend, and the Athletic subscribers, we're gonna be with you again on Monday. So until then, we'll enjoy your hockey, everybody. Bye bye.